This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. What is the information technology strategy for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security? How is DHS modernizing its IT infrastructure and ensuring IT investments align with its overall mission? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Richard, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you back.
Michael, it's great to be back.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Kruiser. George, welcome.
Thank you.
Richard, let's start off and begin with the department itself. Our listeners are very familiar with the Department of Homeland Security in the midst of its seventh year, but perhaps you can give us an overview of its mission and continued evolution.
As you probably know, the department earlier this year completed the quadrennial Homeland Security Review. And as part of that review, decided that it's really focused on five mission areas. And just let me very quickly go through those. Mission area one is preventing terrorism and enhancing security of the country. Two, securing and managing our borders. Three, enforcing and administering our immigration laws. Four, safeguarding and securing cyberspace. And then the fifth is ensuring resilience to disasters. What I have found amazing in my 1 year here is just, as you can imagine, the breadth and diversity of what that entails to carry out those five mission spaces. And it's very, very different, like my experience at the IRS where, I mean, clearly we had different constituencies, but we were administering the tax laws of this country. We're much more focused than what I see here at the Department of Homeland Security.
So with such a critical mission, and you kind of hinted at the scale of operation we're looking at, would you describe how DHS is organized, the size of the budget, full-time employees, and a sense of the mission support that IT actually supports?
Well, let me start with the end. The reason I'm the CIO here and accepted the position is because I believe IT is a foundational and critical element to the success of an organization such as Homeland Security. In fact, I would say that it is as important as any function in assuring mission effectiveness today. The scope and scale of the organization, quite large, 200,000 employees plus, quite a few different mission sets from the standpoint that we actually have 22 individual operating organizations that carry out those five missions that I alluded to before. Not all of them have their own IT departments. Many of the smaller ones are actually served by my organization directly. But most of them have IT organizations. Some of them have designated CIOs. And those CIOs have a dotted line responsibility to myself, where I have the overarching responsibility and authority over the whole IT function for DHS.
Now that we have a sense of the larger organization, I'd like you to dive down into your specific role as the Chief Information Officer. If you could tell us what's really under your purview, how you're organized within the CIO office, and how you support the overall mission.
Well, starting with the top, I just stated that I have overall responsibility and authority for all of IT across the department. So when it comes to things like looking at the overall budget of the organization and supporting that whole budget process and the capital investment planning and investment control process for the whole department, you know, including working with all the organizations on their Exhibit 300 submissions, which are the submissions that need to be made to OMB for the large IT programs, essentially handling those kinds of departmental functions where we are the if you will, liaison to many of the stakeholders, including the Hill, OMB, GAO, and the like. All right. So that's one role that we play. The other role that we play is that we actually have an operational role within my organization. On the enterprise side, we've decided to consolidate down to two enterprise data centers. The operations of those data centers are within my organization. And so we work with the components as we're moving in systems into those data centers. We also have responsibility, overarching responsibility for our OneNet, although we rely heavily on CBP for the day-to-day operations of that today. And finally, in addition, for the headquarters organizations, and that is about 10,000 individuals, we provide day-to-day IT support, so desktop support, things like the email service and phone service and those kinds of basic IT capabilities as well.
Now with a year under your belt, what are the top three challenges that you've faced and what are you doing to address those challenges?
Yes. Spent about 3 months or so really assessing where I thought the organization was in its use of IT and how we were managing IT overall throughout DHS. I really found three areas that are primary importance that I'm trying to address. First, we need to improve how we manage, particularly our largest IT investments. We have some very, very good people across the board. But overall, I would say we're just not managing many of these investments as well as we need to. And so this whole area of both program reviews, essentially my version of the tech stats that Vivek Kundra has done, based on those, there's been significant changes to some programs based on those reviews. But going forward, it's really about institutionalizing, if you will, best practices and really working to make sure that the proper governance and oversight exists for these programs and the proper disciplines are being implemented in these programs to manage them effectively and that we have them properly staffed. Okay, with the right kind of individuals that know how to do this work and oversight this type of work. Number two is really the infrastructure layer. I mentioned earlier we have the data center consolidation initiative within the Department of Homeland Security, our OneNet initiative to bring together one physical network infrastructure. There's other things we're doing. We're rolling out things like rationalizing our Active Directory structure, our email as a service offering through these two data centers. There's a number of things we're doing at an enterprise level that we need to get done. And I say that because it's important for the organization. If you're in the private sector and you do mergers and acquisitions, when you bring companies together, one of the first things you always do is harmonize and, if you will, collapse your IT infrastructure, right, and your back office systems. Perhaps it's taken us longer than it should. One could argue that. But that's exactly what we're doing here at DHS, and we need to finish that job. And that's a big, big focus area of mine right now to help us continue to push that forward and get that stuff done. That will help all of these 22 agencies do their jobs more effectively. And then the third area is kind of an interesting one, and I think goes to the heart of really trying to be one DHS, as the Secretary has discussed. While we're one department, too often we still operate as up to 22 different component organizations. And how that manifests itself in IT is there's just too much of building similar things across these different organizations and not enough leverage and information sharing. And again, there are certainly pockets where we do it. I mean, I'll give you an example, our whole screening function and vetting individuals like at border crossings and the like. A lot of cooperation that goes on there between CBP and ICE and TSA. But in general, there are many, many functions that were replicated. And when I did these reviews, these 81 reviews, you could see it where you have a program that was building something in one component and then you'd see another program later that was building something very similar in another component. And we just need to be collaborating in much better ways. And so this idea of doing a cross-cutting governance model where we're looking at things from a function or portfolio perspective that cross-cut the components, I think, is very critical to get to one DHS. And it's something that I'm pushing very hard on. can't get any of this done without a really good staff. And this isn't to take away from contractors that we hire. They do great work for us. But that being said, we need to have a strong government employee base within our IT functions to make this work. And so getting that right balance, I think, is really critical. When I walked in the door, just to give you a sense of it, in the headquarters function, I had 100 employees or so and about 900 contractors. Well, I think on the face of it, that doesn't sound right. And so we're really looking to rebalance that workforce, and we're aggressively recruiting and getting some very good people to join us as employees. And today I'm proud to say that we have 240 employees on board in my organization 1 year later, and we're headed up above 350 in the next year. So I'm very pleased with how that's going. So I think that's another critical challenge we face, is to get that balance right, not just in my headquarters CIO function, but in some of the other functions, some of the other IT functions, I should say, in the components.
Richard, I'd like to transition to learn more about you. You've spent more than 20 years in the private sector, and now you're on your second stint in public sector. Would you describe your career path to our listeners, and how did you begin your career, and what brought you to your current leadership role?
Sure. First, from an educational perspective, I'm a technologist. I have multiple degrees in electrical and computer engineering, and as a hobby, picked up a math degree. So that gives you a sense of the kind of person that I am. I came out of school and joined, at that time, was a relatively small company, SRA International, which many of you, the listeners, I'm sure would know of, because they do a lot of government contracting work here in town. And I spent 16 years there and started out as an engineer, did quite a bit of work. And at that time, network design and analysis, actually built a lot of algorithms in that particular area. So did quite a bit of actual software development work early in my career. Moved into task management on programs and then actually running smaller projects and then into program management. And so when people ask what's my real specialty area, I really like to say that it is that large-scale program management. Ended up running one of four major divisions at SRA International. And we actually then spun off, and this was back in the heyday of the internet boom, we actually spun off some technology we had developed in data mining. And for about 4 years, I ran a company then called Mantis. And we were selling data mining solutions, looking at trading compliance, looking at anti-money laundering for major banks and brokerage firms, including firms on Wall Street. So I always like to say that I've dealt with some of the toughest customers I think you can possibly deal with. And yet we were quite successful in that. Decided to leave that firm, though, in I think it was 2003, and was really thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I'd always wanted to do some public service, Michael, in my career. I thought it would be at the twilight of my career, frankly. But I got into some discussions through some connections I had at the IRS. And at the time, the gentleman who was running their business systems modernization program, who had come out of retirement actually to do it, was looking to go back into retirement, which is fair. And they were looking for a new leader. And so they offered me that job. So I came into the IRS to run the BSM program, as it's known. Certainly one of the largest, most complex modernization efforts ever undertaken. And did that for 2.5 years or so. And they asked me to become their CIO, and I did that. And then ultimately, they asked me to become the Deputy Commissioner for Operations Support, the number three in the organization at the IRS. And so I had a good run there, about 4.5 years. I run hard. I work hard. And I needed a break. I'd be very honest with you. I needed that break. So I took a year off, did some consulting work, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I got a call to whether I'd be interested in coming into the Obama administration as the CIO of Department of Homeland Security, and looked at that, talked to some folks, and decided to take this on as a challenge. So been here a year.
With that experience, what makes an effective leader in your mind? And more importantly for me, who has influenced you and your leadership style?
I always try to take a view that I'm only going to be as successful as those that are under me. I can certainly focus on that leadership of the direct reports right under me. So I constantly ask myself, am I doing the things that can put them in a position to be successful? Because if I can make that happen, then I will be successful in the role I'm in. People call that servant leadership, and I like that term. I'm not always having to be the guy out front, although I am many times, like here, being the spokesperson for the department on IT issues. But I really try to take that view. How do I help? And in this case, it even also extends to the CIOs and the components, right? How do I position them for them to grow to be successful in their roles with that same philosophy? So that's a sense of why. There's been a number of individuals that I have worked under that have really, I think, helped influence me. And, it might be trite to say, but you start with your parents. I mean, they were great role models for me in how to be a man of integrity, a person of integrity, a person that can be counted on, can be trusted, is so, so important to me. That being said, when I got into the work world, there certainly are a number of individuals, but I might highlight Ted Legacy as a gentleman that I worked with for years, worked under him for years at SRA International. And when you work with someone for 10-plus years in that kind of role and you admire his leadership style and the way he handled things, those kinds of things rub off. So that's one example, a great example for me of a real leader.
What about DHS's efforts to enhance its IT governance? We will ask Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining us today from IBM is George Cruiser. Richard, would you tell us more about the IT strategy for DHS? How are you seeking to modernize and standardize the use of IT for the department?
I'm a real believer that you need to decide where you draw that line in a department like the Homeland Security between what really should be provided as an enterprise service versus what should be provided component specific. And then some of those are easy. The data centers and having those and driving towards data center consolidation really is an enterprise function. We want to move away from components each having their own data centers and bring that stuff together. Great economies of scale, improved network security, efficiencies from a cost and operations perspective, all the good things we talk about even at the federal level, right, that we're working on right now with the VACCONDRA and the CIO Council. But drawing that line is important. Where do we draw that line of what's enterprise versus what's component? To the degree we can continue to refine that, that's a big part of that strategy, continue to refine that where that line is drawn. Really trying to drive a governance model that helps us define where there's leverage potential that should be enterprise. Okay, we have a number of these command centers, and there's technology that supports them. I can think of 12 different common operating pictures that we've built. Do we really need 12 different common operating pictures, right? So that's the kind of leverage I'm talking about and reuse potential and standardization potential that we have. That common operating picture should go from above the line, where it's just component specific, to below the line, where it's really an enterprise capability that's provided. And then built in such a way that it's tailorable, right, configurable, let's call it that, to the particular mission need. And that's the kind of things that we're trying to drive from a strategy perspective.
As you draw that line and build the common operating picture in a department with such complex and multiple missions, I'm sure that creates a secondary challenge to building that. But if you could tell us a little bit about the synergies you've been able to drive at that common level and some of the things that you're working toward. You haven't driven the synergy yet, but you're working toward in the near future.
Well, let's go back to that enterprise level. I mean, well before I arrived, and I would certainly give credit to my predecessors, up to including Margie Graves, who's my current deputy CIO, and Mike Brown, who runs IT services in the organization under myself. Data center consolidation, you know, has been something they've been pushing on for years, and we can continue to drive. The OneNet consolidation we continue to drive. But now we're starting to layer services on top of that. So as an example, earlier this year, we got all the components to agree to putting in a network security infrastructure called policy enforcement points. You can kind of think of these as firewalls on steroids. Let's just call them that, kind of a layman's way of thinking about it. The notion being that rather than having each component have to worry about their own network security, why don't we do that as an enterprise service, but set it up so that you can set up trust zones? Because we may have one physical network infrastructure, but those trust zones and the having that network security managed centrally puts us in a much better security posture. It's another example. We finally have come to agreement across all the enterprise about an Active Directory structure so that we can start to roll out enterprise services in a much more rapid fashion than we were able to before. When I arrived, it would literally take us months to roll out anything that was going to be enterprise-wide. And now we're down to being able to do that in weeks or days once the application's ready to go. We're just now beginning to launch an email as a service offering, okay, that'll be run out of our data centers. And that, again, is a much more effective and efficient way to provide email capabilities through what we're calling our own private cloud offering, right? It's within our data centers, but it looks like a private cloud offering. Those are great synergies that we have been able to put in place, even within the last year. And I'm very, very proud of that and proud of the team and proud of the CIO community and the council in being able to drive that. So those are some good examples at the, if you will, at that enterprise infrastructure level that we're doing.
Richard, you touched on a little bit IT governance, but I'd like to go deeper, if you will. What about its importance? And also, what are the benefits and possible limitations to a federated IT management approach?
One of the real challenges I see is because of the way we're organized. And look, 200,000-person organization, it's going to be a complex organization no matter how you organize, right? But the fact that you have these various components, that many of which have come from other organizations before Department of Homeland Security or were standalone even. So bringing those together and being able to get that kind of synergy in something like IT requires a collaborative effort. And that's where governance comes in, okay? So I'm a huge believer if you can get the right people at the right level around the table with a shared sense of mission or outcome, you really can drive some amazing things. And I saw it. I saw it in the private sector, and I particularly saw it what we were able to do at the IRS, where we were able to draw and bring diverse people together but really come out with mission objectives that they could all agree to and then drive to them, even though they lived in different organizations. I'm working to do the same thing here. Are we as far as I'd like to be? Of course not. But some successes, okay? Two that I would allude to right now. One, we have stood up an IT services governance board. It's chaired by my deputy as well as the deputy CIO for CBP, Ken Richard. And it's got the membership is really the deputy CIOs from across the whole department. And what is it really driving? I mean, I just in the last answer talked about all those enterprise services where, you know, the data centers and OneNet and the Active Directory rationalization, email as a service. That's what this board's all about. Okay? They're the ones that are working those issues, making that happen, and I think to a very effective way. So that's one example. Now let's switch gears. We have something called the Information Sharing Governance Board. And this board is really, as it said, to really look at the whole information sharing that we do across the department and even beyond the department, because for us to be successful, it's both sharing the right kind of information in the right way, respecting privacy and civil liberties and all of that, but being able to share that information as appropriate, both internally as well as with partners. Partners could be other federal government agencies. Partners could be state and local governments, tribal communities, even private sector as appropriate. One of the things I asked this governance board to take on, and they elected to do so, is to really take on the whole issue of this whole information sharing architecture. You know, we have an enterprise architecture. We have to by law. It resides within my organization. But how do you make it real? How do you make it something that's living, that's useful? It's really to look at where do we want to be in 5 years, let's say, the kinds of sharing we want to be able to do, what that means from a policy perspective as well as also from a technical systems perspective. And then where are we today, that kind of to-be state and where we're at now, and then how do we get there? That's really what enterprise architecture should do for you, and it needs to be governed though. And so to bring senior-level executives from across DHS that sit on this information sharing governance board. This isn't just about IT anymore. These are executives from all the major components. It's chaired by Karen Wagner, who runs our intelligence and analysis organization. I'm actually a member of it. It's starting to be effective in really looking at how do we set that vision and then what are those steps to realize that vision. I think you get that thing going, it can be very, very effective for moving that forward. Now, those are two examples. I can think of at least 8 other areas in which I believe this organization should be doing similar things, okay? We do have a screening coordination office, okay? So in the whole screening world, okay, screening being as an example when you come to the border, right? I mean, let's say you arrive internationally on a flight. When you go up to Customs and Border Patrol there, the desk, and you know, they swipe your passport, okay? That's a screening function, okay? They're checking you against particular types of lists, right? Looking for terrorists and the like. That's a screening function. We have a screening coordination office, and they've done great work, highly effective, but I'd still like to see a governance model over that, all right, to help drive that even further, and it's something that I'm talking to that office about. Domain awareness is another function, okay? I mentioned the common operating picture earlier, right, and those systems. That's another area where I believe we could do much better in coordinating and could have a governance function. Long answer to what you were asking about, Michael, but hopefully it gives you a sense for the governance that I think is critical to get the collaboration to drive these things forward. And it helps from an IT perspective, what do we do? But the more important thing is it helps from a mission effectiveness perspective.
And it's a clear vision. It's a clear vision.
With a $6.4 billion IT budget, DHS has an inherent responsibility to be a good steward of the public funds and to invest wisely. I'm interested in your elaboration on what you're doing to strengthen the capital investment process to ensure that these component investments are mission aligned and yet at the same time fit into this vision of an enterprise-wide one DHS, if you will.
Well, George, I would hope that you could appreciate that some of the things I just talked about help with that, right? So to the degree that we're doing things from an enterprise perspective where it makes sense, that's obviously a much more effective, cost-effective way to do it. The governance ideas, to the degree that helps us drive, you know, leverage, build it once and use often, reuse, you know, doing things the smartest way possible, all of those things come together with that governance model I described. That being said, there's certainly other things that we're looking to do to help drive cost efficiencies above and beyond that. Number one, I'm a big proponent that we need to be a smart buyer, right? We buy, I mean, as you alluded to, we're spending $6.4 billion in IT in this department. We need to buy smartly. We need to leverage that buying power in the best way. And whether that's making sure that we bring and pull things together and negotiate to provide, whether it's enterprise license agreements or at least buying in bulk where it makes sense across components, those are initiatives that are underway to just be more efficient about how we buy things and the price points at which we can buy things. So that's certainly another area we're trying to drive cost effectiveness. I would also say that there's an awful lot going on. One of the things that's been put in place is a review process which by my office, any expenditure that's in excess of $2.5 million does pass through my office for review. So we're looking at it from a making sure it aligns the enterprise architecture, making sure that it fits within what that component's strategy really is. And we push back at times when we say, well, what is this and how does that relate to this? And making sure we drive efficiencies, also trying to identify if this is something that they could leverage from another component rather than having to do it themselves. Again, trying to identify leverage opportunities, not duplicating things, getting that most efficient use of funds possible. And I think that process, and I will admit, I mean, some of the components grouse at times having to go through that process, but I think the discipline is very good for them, and it also gives us a lot more insight as to what's going on throughout the department with IT spend.
Well, Richard, I'd like to talk about how you keep the infrastructure, IT infrastructure networks secure. Could you give us a sense of your IT security efforts, and more particularly, to what extent does the migration to OneNet enhance your IT security efforts?
First, let me say that I've been very pleased to come on board. We have a strong CISO in Bob West, and he has built a strong CISO council. So he's got counterparts, just like the department has CIOs that are out there in the components. There are CISOs that are out there in the components. So he runs a CISO council as well. What that team has done is built, and you would say, maybe it's an overused term, but I think it is appropriate to say he's really built a defense-in-depth IT security strategy. I mean, we have adversaries that are sophisticated. We need to have a layered strategy. So some of it is at the perimeter, like at the network layer you're alluding to with OneNet. And I mentioned earlier the implementation of these policy enforcement points, the firewalls on steroids. That's one layer. But we have other layers as well. I mean, we're right now, as an example, for network access, we're implementing, we're rolling out the HSPD-12 cards, these smart cards, right, with the chip on them. We've issued more than 100,000 of those cards across the department. And behind that, we're now looking at the logical access using those cards. I am pleased to say there's no doubt we are more secure today than we were a year ago. Does that mean we are where we want to be? Of course it doesn't. It's a journey. The adversaries are continually changing. We have to adapt to them. So I think we're on the right path, Michael, but it's a constant process. And I think we now realize we're in a world that's just fundamentally different. It has to be baked into everything we do. When we start a project, when we look at an infrastructure upgrade, the security issues are front and center on everything we do now. Just has to be.
How is DHS pursuing data center consolidation? We will ask Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining us today from IBM is George Cruiser. Richard, given your efforts around infrastructure modernization, would you elaborate on your data center consolidation efforts? What are the benefits of pursuing data center consolidation, and what are some of the key challenges?
Sure, Michael. I think that the benefits are manifold. Obviously, we talk a lot today about going green, and with the proliferation of data centers, DHS and our baseline inventory, we've actually located 41 data centers within DHS. Okay, just as an example of that. So right there, it says we should be looking to consolidate it from a power and energy saving standpoint, let alone all the other benefits that are more IT related, if you will, such as our ability to foster more efficiencies in how we run our operation on the IT side, the cost savings, clearly, the security benefits that come with this, because we can get to one security architecture much more easily by having these all these systems consolidated at a much smaller number of data centers. Those are the benefits that that we certainly see by doing this. And that's one of the reasons, too, having done it at DHS, when they asked me to help at the federal level with this, I thought, sure, I mean, I can draw upon the lessons learned that we have in order to help hopefully other agencies and departments as they look at data center consolidation. And to that point, you asked about challenges, right? And it isn't easy, right? Because it is kind of human nature for people to want to control their own environment, right? And for people to get more comfortable with the notion that they at one point they decided to build a data center and they put all their servers in it and they have all their systems running on it, and we come by as the department level and say, we really want to shut that down and move all of that, probably maybe not even move the hardware, but just move the applications into a new environment. We're going to virtualize the servers so you can't actually know where your application is running, on which server it is at any given time, those kinds of things. It's uncomfortable, right? And you got to build a trust that we know what we're doing, that we can deliver, that you're going to get hopefully not just the same level service, but you're going to get improved service out of this. And that takes a while. So, again, I will give credit to my predecessors at DHS that have really, over the last 4 years, have driven this. And I believe we're at that tipping point where we've moved enough into these two enterprise data centers that we've stood up. We've had enough success that we're past that point of, well, I just don't think you guys can do it. They know now we can deliver. Doesn't mean that it's still easy, right? There's lots of things to work through. There's still people that don't want to give up their servers, so to speak. But I believe we've reached that tipping point. But as other agencies embark on this, they're going to have to go through that same type of, if you will, adoption curve. And hopefully we can help organizations accelerate that adoption curve, because I think it is so important for the federal government to get its arms around this. I think there's huge potentials, as I mentioned, in cost efficiencies, but also in energy efficiencies, and then in some of these other more intangible things like fostering more efficiencies on how we share information and being in a more secure IT posture than we are today through this data center consolidation initiative.
Well, there's a lot of talk around things called virtualization or cloud computing. Are you at DHS using either or both of these concepts in practice to make a more efficient provision of services?
Yes, we are. I alluded to earlier this idea of a private cloud, and that's been our main focus on these two data centers, is to set up a virtualized environment that we can then provide a base set of services to the components in order to provide their end user capability. So in some instances, we're moving legacy applications in kind of as they exist. But in others, we're bringing in applications. I mean, email is a great example. We're bringing it in as a service offering now so that they don't have to worry about running an email system anymore. And we still have each component running their own email system. We'll run it as a virtualized service essentially for them. Okay, and so you have that level of cloud offering. And then under that, we do then virtualize like the servers and the like so that you can get the most efficiencies out of that actual hardware. So we're doing that as well. I would also want to point out, Michael, that we're looking at what does it make sense for DHS to buy from commercial service providers and their cloud offerings. And so we're trying to be smart about this. We're not just taking this view that, oh, it's got to be in our data centers. Now, let's also be frank. A lot of the information we have, the data we have, is very sensitive and in some cases even classified data. you know, obviously we have to be very, very careful about the security aspects of that. So I don't think we're going to launch into putting highly sensitive data out into a public cloud kind of offering. But we are really looking hard. Are there applications that make sense for us to go to commercial-based cloud offerings and at least use that as a way to ensure that if we decide to keep it in-house in our, quote, private cloud offering through our data centers, that we're cost competitive, right? I mean, we don't want to be paying twice as much to do it inside as we could do it if we provided it or we went to an outside service offering. It needs to be cost competitive, right? Assuming that the security is there on the outside offering, okay? So hopefully that gives you some sense of how we're looking at private versus public kind of cloud offerings.
Terrorist attacks, national disasters, large-scale criminal incidents all too often serve as case studies to reveal our nation's information sharing capabilities and weaknesses. Would you elaborate on your efforts to enhance information sharing across the extended DHS community? And in addition to that, to what extent do you use and support the National Information Exchange model?
Sure, George. You know, this is obviously a very important set of questions that you've just asked and issues you've brought up. From the perspective of what I'm trying to drive, I alluded to earlier the importance of governance, right, and the Information Sharing Governance Board internal to DHS to really foster more collaboration and the policies that we should have in place for information sharing, if you will, within DHS. But in reality, that board also goes well beyond DHS. And we are working very closely with, for instance, the PM for the information sharing environment out of the White House. It's now Shamendra Paul, who's taken the job recently. We have a very good working relationship with him, looking at how we can be part of that ecosystem for information sharing at all levels of classification, sensitive data and obviously classified data as well, but be part of that ecosystem and be the right kind of partner, right? In sharing the right kind of information, but also having to work through the privacy issues and the civil liberties issues that you have to address to do this right. So we're trying to build, if you will, those communities and strengthen those communities to be able to further that information sharing. And we're making some good inroads in that. We just inked a MOU recently with the Terrorism Screening Center to get more of their information to us on a near real-time basis. And this was information we were only getting updated every 24 hours. Well, 24 hours in this world is now a long time, right? A lot of things can happen. And to now get that information on essentially a real-time basis, we believe closes a major threat vector to us. So that's one great example, a real success story that we've just had. But that doesn't mean we're done by any means, right? There's many other things we need to do. And it's both back into that community of federal partners like FBI and other parts of justice and even the intelligence community. But it's also to those partners on the other side, the state and local organizations, law enforcement organizations. I'm sure you've heard of fusion centers that have been set up. And we play a very key role in providing a lot of data to those fusion centers at the local law enforcement level in order for them to more effectively have information so they can carry out their mission more effectively in support of the homeland. So that's just one example. Now, from a technical perspective, one of the things that we've been a huge proponent of and in fact are the executive agent for right now is this National Information Exchange model. The executive program management of that resides within my organization right now, and I am one of the members that sits on the executive council for NIEM, as we call it, National Information Exchange Model. And what is it? It's really an XML-based set of protocols that, if you will, define how you're going to share information. And it's domain-specific, meaning that there's a domain for information about people that we use. I mentioned screening earlier, okay? So we use NIEM to share information amongst systems within DHS, okay? We use NIEM to share information about people again, with the right protections with other organizations as appropriate. But now HHS is going to adopt NEEM for sharing health care information, okay? And there's a domain in NEEM around sharing maritime information. So we've taken this concept of defining ways in which, I mean, you share information and what each of these data elements mean and how they're structured in an XML schema, and we're extending that. And the beauty of that is you build to that NEEM standard and then you can immediately exchange rather than having to do one-off information, if you will, negotiation for each system. Okay, so it's a force multiplier for the government, if you will, in these various areas. And I really should give Justice Department as well as DHS credit, who were really the founders of NEEM, okay, and have driven this forward over the last four plus years. And now it's really picking up momentum. And we've got – there's our examples of NEEM being used by all 50 states now. So that gives you some examples. Some foreign governments are now using NEEM. So this is a great example of really a bottoms-up thing that happened. This was not driven top-down to start. But now with, you know, and I mentioned Shimendra Paul, the PM of the Information Sharing Environment. He was really one of the founders of NEEM and has been a huge proponent. Of course, you can imagine in his new role, he's really pushing it out there. OMB, in their guidance around the FY12 budget submission, talks about NEEM and challenges organizations. How are you going to be using NEEM in the future? So it really is something that now is being used on a government-wide basis, even though it started out really focused on law enforcement for justice and Department of Homeland Security.
What does the future hold for information technology at DHS? We will ask Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, An Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts and greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining us today from IBM is George Cruiser.
I'd like to look into the future a little bit, and based on your experiences both at IRS and at Homeland Security, what emerging technologies you see as promising for the CIO and the CIOs of the future.
Okay, let me mention a few from a technology perspective. I think in particular for DHS, I mean, it really is all about the mission, right, out there in the field. And so one of the things that the technology is changing so rapidly in is the use of personal digital assistants, right, or PDAs, and I don't want to get into brand names necessarily, but we all know what they are. We all use them every day in our lives. And of course, we're using them within DHS, but when you look at the Border Patrol agent out there, right, on the front line, as that technology continues to evolve and we can leverage that technology, the ability to get information to that officer out there in the field, the right kind of information at the right time for them to be able to effectively do their job is critical. And you take things like the Southwest border where, frankly, things like cellular coverage becomes an issue, right? I mean, we take it for granted here in Washington, D.C. area. You've got that kind of coverage. In many places in the United States in which we have to provide services and services that are at sometimes can mean life or death, that's very critical to us. So as those technologies continue to evolve, those are areas in which we're looking at right now. How do we help the industry evolve those technologies, and then how do we leverage those technologies within our infrastructure to support, the agents out there in the field doing the good mission work that the DHS does? And that's one example. I believe that the whole area – we talked about cloud computing. That whole area of continuing to rationalize the infrastructure is an area that we're going to keep a close eye on because there's just so much leverage potential there that we need to garner. I'd also like to think and this is it's been very difficult. I mean large-scale government solutions, many of which legacy solutions that were built 20, 25 years ago, even more, right, that are maybe old COBOL-based systems, millions and millions of lines, right, of business logic that are baked into those systems. And yet we want to modernize those things, right? We want to retire all of that. Technologies that enable us to do more of that more effectively, okay? That's a key area to me. How do we break out of this albatross that we have around our necks within federal IT of these legacy systems that nobody's fault, but they just weren't modernized over time. So we've got ourselves in a bad place with many of these legacy systems. It's very, very difficult to modernize them, yet they're absolutely critical to the day-to-day operations of many federal agencies. So hopefully, George, it gives you a little bit of sense for some of the technologies that we're trying to look at.
With all of this advancement, are the characteristics in a successful CIO, are they changing at all? Are there new things that the next round, as you talked about, really making your team successful? What are you driving in that group?
Well, let me say that I've always believed that a successful CIO is – it's not just about technology, right? And if you picked up on some of my critical things like governance – and talking about bringing people together to make those kinds of key decisions, a lot of those are about business or mission decisions. They're not about technology decisions. And I believe the role of a CIO is to really be that bridge. The CIO should know enough, and I guess I have a bias coming from a technology background that I think it's a very good grounding to be a CIO, right, to have an information technology, strong technical background. That being said, it's not enough. It's not even close to being enough. To be an effective CIO, to bring that leadership, really means you have to be able to work well in a very heterogeneous environment like this and be able to bring people together and really show them, I mean even sell them on these concepts of how you can govern more effectively and bring people together to make better decisions for the department that then will enable us to bring technologies to bear to help mission effectiveness. And so that's a whole set of skills and experiences and CIOs that are well beyond the technology role. And I don't know if that's new per se because I've always felt that way since I've been in the industry. I think that it's being more and more recognized as an important function, particularly within industry. I'd like to say within the federal government. I don't believe it's been as recognized in the federal government as much as it should be. But in industry, you look at the leaders in their fields in almost any industry today, and they really are out in front in leveraging IT to support their business, right? In almost every case, And I think we need to bring that same kind of viewpoint to how we run federal agencies.
Richard, you've had a wonderful career, both in the private sector and now again a second stint in the federal sector. What advice would you give someone who's interested in a career in public service?
I would I would encourage individuals that are on the fence as to whether or not they might go into public service or go into the private sector early in their career. I think a stint in public service is a very valuable thing to do. Now, of course, I didn't start my career in public service, so it's I don't bring that experience of starting in it. But I do believe the opportunities to have an impact early in your career. You think of the government and large federal agencies as these massive bureaucracies in which you're lost. And yet I've seen so many examples where young individuals with good ideas and really persisting in good ideas or being part of teams can have tremendous impact on an area. And so I urge young people to really consider it as a way to get great experience, even if they only do it for 4 or 5 years, as a way to launch your career. And then maybe you move to the private sector. But maybe you come in and you absolutely love it and want to make a career out of public service. And then on the other side of it, for those of us like myself that have had successful careers in the private sector, I particularly urge individuals all the time to potentially consider a career in public service. It's got tremendous frustrations. Don't get me wrong. I mean, some days I go home and I wonder, why am I doing this to myself? But most days I go home and I say, this is some of the most satisfying work I've ever done, even though it's some of the most difficult to make and bring it all together. Because when you do, when you advance the ball, and I really do believe we are advancing the ball in DHS, when you advance the ball, it's got such an important impact. In this case, helping secure this country. And it really does bring a real sense of personal value with it that I like. And obviously, you all have to make your own decisions about the way you want to have your career go. But I have found it to be extremely fulfilling. So I urge people when they ask me about it to consider it and find what are you passionate about. And I'm sure that whatever you're passionate about, you can find somewhere in public service that matches that passion.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us again, for coming back to the show. But more importantly, George and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, Michael and George, thank you first for having me on the show, and thank you for that compliment. I believe I work every day to earn that compliment. And as I said earlier, it's really a privilege to be part of the federal government. And it's really a privilege, by the way, to be part of the Homeland Security team.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. My co-host from IBM has been George Cruiser. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Local and state governments are under tremendous pressure to do more for citizens and do it better. How is technology helping local and state governments do just that? How is the state of Illinois using technology to improve human service delivery? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with special guest Ivan Handler, Chief Information Officer at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.